Lock the gates!
All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers, what the fuck buddies, what the fuck nicks, what's happening? I'm Mark Maron. This is my podcast. Welcome to it. How are you? I feel better. I don't feel 100%. I'm close to, I think, being all better. I don't know. You know, it's hard to know with the COVID situation. My tests are looking good. There's progress being made. I will test again this week and hopefully get tomorrow, actually. Maybe today. Today I'll test again and maybe get the full neg. We'll see. We'll see. But I am through the worst of it, I do believe. Tony Kushner is on the show. He's kind of a genius, a wizard, an intellect, and an artist. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright of Angels in America, the musical Caroline or Change, and a frequent collaborator with Steven Spielberg, writing the screenplays for Munich, Lincoln, and now West Side Story. He's also the husband of Mark Harris, the film historian guy who I had on here. We had a good talk. And I asked Mark, I said, is Tony in the other room? And he said, yeah. And now we talked a little bit about Mark this time. Anyways, this is a very thrilling interview, a very good interview. I was nervous. You know, I never know if I can hang with these intellectual heavyweights, but I'm a big fan of a lot of his work. And it was a great conversation. That's coming up. I've been trying to figure out a way that me and Guillermo del Toro can hang out again on the podcast and just, you know, talk about shit. So I had this idea that maybe I would ask him, because I'm not a horror movie guy. I don't like thrillers. I don't like suspense. I don't like horror. I get bored. I get frustrated, or I get disturbed. It doesn't seem to work for me like it works for people who like it. Okay? I don't... Frustrated, anxious, disturbed. I don't need those. I don't need that from my entertainment. I really don't. And that's what people see horror as. It's primarily entertainment, right? And I know there's art horror movies. I get it. But I don't need those elements, you know, frustrated, anxious, disturbed. I've got that going on now. That's my baseline. I guess maybe for some people, horror and, you know, kind of slasher movies or, you know, splatter horror and all that stuff. Maybe it has a Ritalin effect for some people. Maybe the horror on the screen sort of diminishes or dampens or tempers the feelings that I have. But it doesn't have that effect with me. Yeah, you know, I watched this movie last night, the last one of the three that I was assigned by... Guillermo, Kill List, and by the time that movie was over, I couldn't sleep, and I was terrified, and I keep a minor lookout. I don't think it triggers the proper response. I don't have the correct sense of humor around horror, or the correct appreciation of the genre, or necessarily the ability to separate myself from the action on screen as being a reality of some kind. Especially that one, because it's sort of grounded in a disturbing reality. You know, you don't know right away that you're dealing with this. It's a fairly traditional horror movie ending. But the other stuff you had me watch, I watched Haxen, which is a 1922 movie. That's, I think it's Danish for witch. And it's like half documentary, half sort of cinematic exploration of medieval witchcraft, Inquisition witchcraft, how witches are treated. And then it comes into the current time, being 1922, about how mentally ill people are treated. And in the past, they would have been witches. And now they're institutionalized, which is, you know, not great either. It was an interesting movie. And the composition and the narrative storytelling within the black and white stuff, you know, the silent movie stuff was amazing. And apparently there's a 1968 version of it that was narrated by Bill Burroughs, who I love. But I was happy I saw that. The other one I watched was Barbarian Sound Studio, which is, you know, a movie about a guy, a British guy, who takes a job as the sound mixer for an Italian horror movie. And then it just gets weird at the end. It's some sort of psychological thriller that takes place during the making, or basically the sound edit of an Italian horror movie, I guess, like Argento movie. But I don't know any of those movies. And I think that this movie was just a, you know, you needed that as an index, as a point of reference. You needed to be somewhat of an Italian horror nerd or an Argento nerd. So I don't know that stuff. And I found it a little tedious and a little boring. And I don't like movies generally where at the end of them, you're like, did he die? What happened? What did that light mean? Was he in the movie? Or was the movie, the one I was watching, was that the movie? Or was it the movie that he was in? Did he lose his mind and think he was in the movie? Did he die? What happened? That's not a great feeling to me. It's better than being terrified, but it is a bit frustrating. I can handle it, you know, from an art movie. I can handle it, but I feel like I missed most of that movie. So anyways, my foray into horror has made me realize three things. I think that in time I could appreciate it, but I do not enjoy what it does to me. Okay? Frustrated, anxious, disturbed. I'm on top of that. I'm already doing that. I don't need more of that. Okay? And if you give me a lot more of it, it's not going to make mine feel any less immediate. It's not going to make it feel any less there. You understand what I'm saying? Do you? So, Tony Kushner is a, as I said earlier, a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright. Angels in America, both parts, were masterpieces, amazing experiences theatrically for me. I think I saw the original cast in Angels in America, I believe. I think, was that Ron Liebman as Roy Cohn? I think I did see that. It was it changes your life and your mind forever. I did see his musical, Carolina Change, when I was in the city, and I loved it. But he's a very impressive thinker. He's a very impressive artist, and it's a very specific type of art, playwriting, writing in general, I believe. And if you think about the movies that he did with Spielberg, Munich, Lincoln, now West Side Story, the dialogue's amazing, and the storytelling is amazing, and Munich's amazing, and they're all fucking amazing. This guy's he's a heavyweight. He's a real deal, and he's a great thinker, and he knows stuff, and I don't. I know a few things, and sometimes when I don't know things, I say I don't know them. There's nothing wrong with saying I don't know, but you don't want to necessarily, you know, interrupt somebody to get a lesson about something you should probably just do on your own later. But with Tony, I don't know what Brechtian really implies. I know Bertolt Brecht. I don't have a conscious memory or understanding of many of his plays. I maybe have seen one back in college, but when something's Brechtian, I know it means something. So I asked. I think I asked more than that. But it was really a great privilege to talk to Tony. We did this by Zoom. For one, I had COVID. For two, he's in New York. But I did watch both West Side Stories back to back. And you know what? They're both amazing. I don't remember seeing the first one. I must have seen it when I was a little kid because I knew a lot of the songs, but they're both really great. The West Side Story that Tony wrote for Steven Spielberg is playing in theaters. He's been nominated for a Writers Guild of America Award for Best Adapted Screenplay. And we talk about all of it. The whole thing, the Tony Kushner thing. Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer. And I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago. Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF. All right, here we go. So, Tony, what's happening? What's going on in New York? What's happening right now?
In New York specifically, I don't know.
Is it cold?
It's cold. It's the Omicron numbers are going down.
They're going up in my house. I have it right now. I am
really?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Are you okay?
I think I'm okay. I've been a little stuffy and a little tired, and I had to cancel some dates. But I'm not. I'm triple vaxxed. And full of terror, and that seems to have been made. I'm okay. I'll be happy when it's out of me.
Yes, and I don't think you should be full of terror. It doesn't seem to really be up to very much. It kind of goes in and makes your head stuffed up, and then it goes away.
Did you get it?
I have not gotten it. We've avoided it because we don't go anywhere. We stay in our apartment basically all day long, and we don't have kids, and we.
Yeah.
Where we were antisocial before the pandemic started. So
this has been like a literal heyday for you.
Yeah, in some ways, yes.
Yeah. What have you found has evolved over the last 2.5 years in your relationship because of the pandemic?
I think it's actually been good for our relationship. We were both in pretty bleak, terrible place when it started, as everybody was. And it was, there were so many kind of apocalyptic warnings about what was going to happen in New York.
It did get there. It got pretty close.
Well, it got very bad, but there was, in the weeks before it actually really broke out, there were, people saying that the whole social fabric would disintegrate and people would be murdering people on the streets. There would be no toilet paper, really things would just be, terrible. Mark, who doesn't really like to grocery shop, went out the weekend before and came home with like 8 shopping bags full of meat, which we then tried to jam into our freezer because he got convinced that there would be no more meat available.
I think everybody got convinced that there would be no more something, and they did everything they could to get as much of that as possible.
Wasn't there like a moment where there were no Fig Newtons?
The panic was crazy.
There were no Fig Newtons and then no grape nuts.
I got concerned about about basics. I found myself buying a 10-pound bag of quinoa because I just saw myself eating some sort of quinoa mush for the duration.
Yeah, you could probably get by on quinoa.
That's what I thought.
Yeah. So we were like freaked out at first. We have a house in Provincetown, and we packed up my sister and we fled to Provincetown and sat out the first few weeks there, and then decided we wanted to come back to New York. I feel grateful to him because he gets nervous and also has a kind of a darker worldview than I do and expects terrible things to happen. So he was ready for this before almost anybody else was. And I think that's one of the reasons we didn't get one of the more severe forms of this. I finally just surrendered to his very strict protocols. So, I married the right guy, and it worked out okay. And, we feel like we've gotten ourselves through this together. And, it's not the blitz. It's not.
Yeah.
But it has been a tough thing. And
right. But that's interesting that you have these two different ways of looking at the world. What do you think that is? Because I'm more like Mark. Like, I was kind of ready because I'm dreading everything anyways. So when it's time to activate, especially, something that's so rooted in anxiety, I'm ready to go. I'm on top of it.
Yeah.
I'm like, I don't need paper towels. I'm going to buy 1,000 dish rags. And we're just, but you, what are you able to find hope on a day-to-day basis or what?
I think I'm a little bit more optimistic than he is. I think we kind of balance each other out. I mean, he can get very quickly convinced that we are completely and totally screwed. Can I say fucked? I don't know if I can say fucked.
You can say fucked. Yeah, sure.
They were really fucked. And and I'm not a denialist, but I have a kind of a fatalistic sort of optimism. And I feel like things tend to cohere rather than the opposite. So I sort of believe that, it won't be as bad as Mark thinks it will be. But I admire people like Mark and you who sort of anticipated. I was doing research a few years ago on a project that had to do with Italian history and the Risorgimento in the middle of the 19th century. And I was in Siena, and I was meeting with a Jewish woman there who sort of ran the Siena synagogue.
Uh-huh.
Her family had left right before Mussolini started rounding up Italian Jews. And I said, why do you think he had that insight? And she said he was an incredible depressive. He was a clinically depressed man. And he took a train ride back from Germany with a Nazi and came home and said, pack up everything, we're getting out of here.
Okay.
And they fled. So sometimes it's a good thing to have that.
All right. So when does Mark say it's time for us to leave then?
Well, since 2016, we've actually had a couple of those, should we be putting, we don't have very much money, but should we be putting what we have in a Swiss bank is will we be able to get out quickly enough? Can we?
Yeah.
Will Steven Spielberg give us a berth on his yacht? I mean, is there a way to get out of here?
So far he
hasn't sounded that particular alarm that we have to get in the car and go to Canada. But
can you guys get into Canada? He's not Canadian, is he?
I don't know. I always assumed that the Canadian, maybe because I've watched The Handmaid's Tale too much, but if we can get across the border, they'll let us in.
Well, I mean, I don't think any of us have tried, nor have we needed to try, to get refugee status. So
right.
I imagine that will be the shift in border policy, is if you show up with all your vaccines or proof of having had COVID and a refugee request.
Yeah. And then just like, all those Brecht poems would be sitting on the border waiting for some asshole to decide whether you're going to get over the border or whether you have to, kill yourself. It's scary. My brother is a musician in Vienna, and his orchestra, the Vienna Symphoniker, plays during the summer and on the Bodensee in this big opera festival called the Bregenzer Festspiel. And they have to, to the opera house, he has to cross this border crossing in Switzerland. And it's the border crossing where all of these Austrian Jews tried to, get out of, through which all these Austrian Jews tried to get out of Austria after the Anschluss. And so he's called me a few times during the darker moments of the Trump presidency and said, are you sure you don't want to come open up a bank account in Vienna?
Wow.
There have been moments when you think,
I know. I'm like Ireland. I'm thinking Ireland. I'm a Jew and I've got some sort of weird connection emotionally to Ireland for reasons I don't understand. And I fantasize about it, but then I try to kind of realize it's a fantasy. And I don't know that if I got to, if I go to Ireland, that they're going to be like, oh, thank God you're here. finally.
I'm sure they would welcome you.
They seem all right. But I mean,
Leopold Bloom. It's
What am I going to do there?
You want to hear a good Irish Jewish joke?
Yeah.
So this Jewish guy is this is during the Troubles, and he has to go across the border from the Republic of Ireland to Northern Ireland. And he's nervous, and he gets to the borderline, and he gets to the official thing, and then he's driving, and suddenly these guys with balaclavas and hats come out on the road with shotguns, and they stop his car, and they go up to the car, they rap on the window, and he rolls down the window, and the guy says, are you a Protestant or a Catholic? And the guy says, I'm Jewish. And the man with the gun says, yeah, but are you a Protestant Jew or a Catholic Jew?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah, that's funny. So I'm still panicky. I can't get a sense of what the world is really like from my phone, and my life is okay. But when you take in information, how you contextualize it or how big you make it in your mind or what it represents, it's very tricky to figure out, what exactly is happening.
Yeah. And we're entering the third year of this. If Omicron isn't sort of the thing that brings us to some kind of conclusion, I do think that there are reasons to believe that, it has caused a tremendous amount of tearing of the social fabric. And there is some reason to believe that if it doesn't get if life doesn't return to some degree of normalcy and if people can't congregate and resume ordinary sort of non-digital relationships. I mean, things have already gotten very weird, and I think they're going to get weirder. It's a scary time, and what's happening in this country is terrifying. So
what, now on a day-to-day basis, how do you sort of, what do you do? I mean, do you take in the news? Has any of this, like, you know, with COVID and with what you just said and sort of being in this moment, does that inspire you at all?
You mean the bad stuff?
Yeah. Creatively.
Creatively. When it's really bad, no. I mean, or at least not in the immediate moment. I'm not somebody who can take in terrible, you know, a really terrible news cycle and immediately process it in some way.
Yeah.
I try to pay attention, and I try and take notes, and I try to keep track of how the reality that's coming to me through outside sources jibes with my sort of fantasies of how reality ought to go and my theoretical understanding of history and reality. I mean, I know that that's a kind of a back and forth process. That's a dialectic that eventually will result in work.
Right.
When I write something, for the most part, I'm drawn to subjects that, you know, feel like they're of significance because they involve sort of agonizing questions that I don't know the answers to.
Right.
And these are very often political questions.
Yeah.
But I've always been in awe of people like Larry Kramer, who, you know, in the middle of the AIDS epidemic, when things were really, you know, the pandemic is horrible and terrifying, and it's global, which is a whole other thing, but it's not lethal in the way that, I mean, even Delta and the first one, Alpha, doesn't feel like the same death sentence that AIDS felt in the early years, where if you were a gay man and you had sex and you know, were sort of sitting around wondering if your number was up and if you'd be dead in 6 weeks and dead in a really horrible, horrible way. You know, in the middle of all of that, Larry somehow took all of his rage and his anger and his frustration and having just been fired by Gay Men's Health Crisis, and he turned it into the normal heart. And I was very close to Larry for a long time, and I still don't understand how that was possible. I don't know how
he found the will,
but also the clarity. I mean, you know, it's Normal Heart is a beautiful play, and it's a powerful play. It's also like a pretty insightful, incisive analysis of like what happens to power structures and also conventional prejudices when they're confronted with a catastrophe. I mean, he really dissects it kind of beautifully, and the different characters. I mean, it's the way that different people react to this horrific news and this horrific new reality. I mean, the tracing through of that is—it's done so beautifully and with such incredible honesty and unsparing truth. And you know, Uncle Tom's Cabin, Louisa May Alcott. I mean, there are people who do that, and it's astonishing when they do. Mostly,
it's sort of—it seems like that template would be very effective, you know, as a means to take on even what we've been through over the last 6 years.
Absolutely. I mean, it's for me, I need a little bit more perspective. I need a little distance. Right. I started writing Angels in America in the around 87.
How old were you?
I was 32 when I started working on it.
Now, like, okay, so you decide to take that on, like, you know, obviously the vision that you had was less personal than Larry's, I guess. Correct.
And it was a few years into the epidemic.
Right.
So AZT had arrived already.
Right.
And things were a little bit more, not good by any means, but there were tests. There was AZT. Things had that terrible thing at the beginning in the early 80s, where you discovered your first lesion and then you were dead a few months later. That had sort of begun to stop. When I began to think about writing Angels. And by the time I finished it in 1990, we were already, I think, pretty well on our way to the triple cocktail. and real transformation of the way the disease was managed.
So in terms of your creative process, what do you see, you know, what needed to happen between sort of you and Larry, not as individuals, but in his approach and your approach? How did the picture come into focus for you? Did your brain need to create these characters or these, you know?
Well, I mean, it sort of goes back to what we were talking about and the difference between me and Mark, although this is not, I think, a difference between us as far as writers. There's a huge difference, you know, in Virginia Woolf's Room of One's Own, she talks sort of enviously. She talks about the Bronte sisters, I think, and Jane Austen and Shakespeare. And just, I think, maybe misquoting her, but I think that what she says about Austen is that there's this kind of, that the Brontes, there's a rage in the novels of Emily and Charlotte Bronte, and that Jane Austen's work, I think she says, is miraculous because it seems to have been written without any anger at all. And then she says that's actually maybe one of the things about Shakespeare that makes him the greatest of all, is that it's written without anger. I have a lot of anger, but I don't know that I find anger an enormously useful tool in writing plays. Larry was an anger artist. I mean, Larry was he could be delightful. He could be very sweet. He could be very funny.
I talked to him once. I when I was at Air America. You know, when he wasn't ill or anything. He was old. I can't remember when that was. It was probably 2003, I guess. It was great. It was a great afternoon to talk to.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was amazing. He had great stories.
It was for that book, Today's Gay Man, or Today's...
The Tragedy of Today's Gays.
Yes, that...
where without my permission, he took an email that I had written to him.
Oh,
And used it as the blurb in the back of the book.
No kidding. Did you have
do that all the time? You could never write to Larry with any certainty that what you were writing was private. It would almost certainly, if he thought it had any sort of like propagandistic, proselytizing value, he would use it and he lives life in a very public way. So
yeah. You know. Yeah, I'm familiar with it. I think I'm that kind of Jew myself. You know, the angry guy. But so you learned at some point that anger was not a good tool for you. Because like where did you get your chops? I mean, when did you start working out as a playwright?
I grew up in Louisiana and I came to New York as to go to Columbia as an undergrad. And the minute I got here, I started seeing every play I could see.
Something you grew up wanting to do? I mean,
yeah, my mother, my parents were professional musicians. And
what kind of music?
My father is a Juilliard trained clarinetist and my mother was an Eastman trained bassoonist. She was very successful. She was a first bassoon of the New York City Opera when she was very young. One of the first women in the country, I think, to have a principal chair. And she recorded with Stravinsky on two occasions. And she was a great bassoonist. My father was a really wonderful clarinetist, but he had the misfortune of being the same age as Stanley Drucker. So when Stanley Drucker was emerging as the world's greatest clarinetist, he was taking all the jobs in New York. And my father wasn't getting enough work. So my sister, who's a year and a half older than I, was born deaf. And my parents freaked out about that a little bit, I think. And my father decided that he would move the family down to Louisiana where he was born. And our family had a little lumber business. And so we grew up in Louisiana and then...
In the lumber business.
In a lot of Jews in the lumber business in Louisiana. It's a weird but true thing.
Have you sort of done a kind of personal history? How did the Jews get to Louisiana?
Jews got to Louisiana through the rag trade, I think. Oh. I mean, there are two ways. One was they arrived in New York and got a big bag of trash of rags and sort of peddling it or pots and pans. And then all along the way, in what they call the Southern Crescent, one of them would find a congenial town and eventually get a little department store and it would turn into a big department store. And so like Maison Blanche in New Orleans, there's a chain called Muller's Neiman Marcus in Houston, and all the way through the South, there are these big department chains that were owned by Jews who had started out as rag peddlers. And I think they arrived in Louisiana that way. Also, they came through Galveston. Some came through Galveston, Texas, which is near where I grew up. I've been told, I don't know if this is true, that the Polish aristocracy, which really severely limited what Jews were allowed to do in the 18th and 19th century, 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th centuries, you could make vodka, you could be a tailor of some kind, you could lend money, of course. And supposedly they allowed Jews to mill lumber.
Uh-huh.
And I found a couple of references in Polish literature from the turn of the century of Jewish lumber mill owners.
That's interesting. So it was either banking or lumber.
Banking or vodka. It used to, I don't know if it's still true, but if you go to any Polish city, you could find a bottle of vodka called Zid vodka.
Yeah.
And it Yid vodka, basically. And it had this sort of anti-Semitic caricature of a Jew on the label. And it was, you know, Poles would tell you, oh, this is the Jew. When there were Jews here, they used to make the best vodka. So I think, you know, like all the Swedes came to New York and then they went to Minnesota because they somehow knew that that was great dairy country. I mean, people found places to replicate what they had come from. So maybe there are a lot of pine forests. Maybe there are three or four big lumber businesses in Louisiana that were founded by Jewish families, and a very, very tiny one that was founded by my family, which no longer exists. But
it's sort of interesting, though, because, like, you know, the film business, too, it's always junk men or rag men. It's a very vague title, and you kind of get a sense of it. But, you know, how do junk men and rag men ultimately open all the department stores and create Hollywood? You know, it's kind of amazing.
Yeah, ferocious determination and intelligence. And
yeah, it's amazing. So, all right, so you grew up in lumber, but was your dad a bitter man or no?
No, he wasn't. Like me, he had a I think I got my fatal optimism from him, fatalist optimism from him. I think, you know, he never gave up the clarinet. And then about 10 years after we moved down there to Lake Charles, he was offered a job conducting a symphony in Alexandria, Louisiana. And he found his true calling, I think. He was really a conductor. And he conducted both the Alexandria and Lake Charles symphonies. And he was great. He did a beautiful job. They were really wonderful orchestras. And my mother was his first bassoon.
Wow. How's that worked out?
Had a pretty good life there.
That's it. And they didn't have to, they just stayed in the lumber business and played music.
He went to the lumber business and added up numbers and came home. He really didn't care about it at all.
Yeah.
And I think he was relieved when he finally could just sort of walk away from it. The Black family in Lake Charles that had been the foreman of my great-grandfather's company when he founded the lumber company, and then the foreman of my grandfather's company were the father and then son of a Black family called the Berard family.
Yeah.
And then their son was my father's foreman, and my father eventually sold the lumber business to him, and it became the Kushner Berard lumber business. And then I can't remember which hurricane it was. Now it wasn't Katrina. It was Gustav, I think, flooded Lake Charles and destroyed the lumber business.
That's a classic American tale.
Yeah. It's ended weird. My hometown has sort of become the poster child globally for climate change. It keeps getting hit by one superstorm after another.
Huh.
And it's having a terribly hard time. You can't insure property down there anymore.
Do you have people down there still?
No, my father died in 2012.
Yeah.
I have a few friends, but they're still there and they're struggling through, but it's a hard place to be.
Lake Charles is one of my favorite Lucinda Williams songs.
Yeah. She's one of our star alumni.
What a song. So, okay, so you leave, you get out of Louisiana, you go to Columbia, and you start just taking in theater because...
The reason I went to Louisiana is because when my parents got there, my mother continued to play the bassoon, but she had a very sort of large creative soul, and she decided to try acting. Uh-huh. So she became an actor. And that's, I think, when my fascination with theater, all to do with Oedipus.
Right.
I loved her and I loved watching her on stage, and she was a sort of tragedian of the local little theater, community theater. And I fell in love with theater, I think, because of seeing her play Linda Lohman in Death of a Salesman.
Was she great?
Thanks. I thought she was great. I really remember Death of a Salesman. I was 6 years old, and I remember it really vividly.
It's just a brutal play, too.
It is, and I had no idea what was going on. The woman who plays Willie Loman's Chippy, the lady in the hotel room,
yeah,
who Biff meets briefly.
Right.
The young woman who was playing that part had slipped and broken her arm, so she had her arm in a cast. And I thought that's why everybody in the play was so upset. I didn't know that Willie had died or anything. I thought they were really freaked out that she had broken her arm. But
a child's interpretation.
Yeah.
It's very literal. Like
they did it in the round.
Uh-huh.
And so I could see the adults on the other side. And when my mother came out and did the speech by the graveyard, you know, attention must be paid, you know.
Yeah,
and you foolish man, why did you do it? I could see all the people on the opposite side. I mean, people that I knew who were grown-ups. It was the early 60s, so they didn't have waterproof makeup. And everybody had raccoon eyes, just like sobbing. And that made an impression. I knew something. I didn't know what it was, but I knew that she was doing something to these people that was pretty extraordinary and powerful. And I got... I think turned on by that. I think
that was it.
Yeah, that was it. I want to do that.
A room full of running mascara.
A room full of weeping women with raccoon. Who could ask for anything more?
Oh God! So when you're coming up in New York, I mean, who were the playwrights that like you found were modeling your perception?
I arrived at a really good moment. I came to Columbia in 1974, and it was, I think, this there was this sort of extraordinary explosion of incredibly brilliant avant-garde theater artists. It's when Robert Wilson, Letter to Queen Victoria, and Einstein on the Beach with Philip Glass, was at the Met and in a Broadway theater. Richard Foreman.
Oh yeah.
Joanne Acolytis, the theater group Mabu Minds with Lee Brewer and Joanne Acolytis, the performance group with Elizabeth Lecomte and Spalding Gray and Willem Dafoe before he became a movie star. A whole bunch of other people who were just doing absolutely mind-boggling, brilliant, radical things. And I think that that's where I was first drawn. I was a very political kid, and I was not sure that theater was a dignified profession for somebody who really wanted to. I went to Columbia because I wanted, you know, I had been obsessed since 1968 with those pictures of the students taking over the president's low library and everything. And that's what I thought I was coming to. It wasn't like that by 1974. But I was, I think, apprehensive about a life in the arts and in theater because it seemed sort of trivial. And
Well, that's interesting, though, if I can stop you, like, because at some point you didn't have any romanticization of like the People's Theater or anything of the socialist theater of the, I guess it would be the 30s, that there was a relevance that could have impact. You never thought that, really?
It's well, that's a complicated question, because they had and hadn't had impact. I didn't feel in anything that I was reading that Clifford Odets or the group theater. I mean, they had sort of radicalized, they had revolutionized theater, certainly in a way. I've always had a big problem with Clifford Odets plays. I mean, I hate to say that, but.
What is the problem?
I don't think they're very good. I shouldn't say that. I mean, I feel bad saying that. I really like.
Heavy-handed?
Heavy-handed and not, you know, if you're going to write about politics, your politics have to be really, really good. You have to really think through what you're doing. His analysis is not particularly, I mean, they're sort of allegorical in places where political theater should never be allegorical. I mean, or metaphorical or something. I mean, you know, that he tries to represent economic processes through
a boxer.
a boxer who was also a world-class violinist. And, right, you know, it's like, okay, I get it, but it's a little corny. And once you figure out what equals what, you know, as opposed to, let's say, Death of a Salesman, which is shatteringly great and is a play that is absolutely about economics, but what Miller did was to find, you know, a circumstance that was sitting out there for everybody to see, a salesman who's about to be, you know, let go because he's not of use anymore. And he exposes the savagery and the cruelty of the way working people are treated, of the way that we're all treated, the way that we're victimized by this artificial system that we've created. And Death of a Salesman touches on many, many other, you know, really fascinating political economic questions, but he does it by being absolutely true to what he's writing about. I mean, you know, it's that family is, except for the fact that they're Jews and they seem to have come from the West to New York. That's the only slightly odd, odd thing, you know.
I just saw before the COVID, I saw the, what is it, View from the Bridge?
View from the Bridge. Oh, my God. It's so great.
Oh, my God. Well, so I saw that with Letts. Tracy Letts was in it right before the plague. And it's devastating.
Oh, it's astonishing. And it's one place where Arthur really digs into issues about, I mean, it's very political. It's also sexual in a way and gets into some really scary stuff. I love View from the Bridge. I think it's, I mean, you know, when he decided it was time to write Death of a Salesman, he took his last nickel and bought some lumber. He had purchased a little from writing TV things and stuff. He had purchased a tiny piece of land in Connecticut, and he built a little house and then went into the house and wrote Death of a Salesman. And that's that's the thing about Arthur Miller is he was also, I mean, he was a great writer and just as a playwright, a spectacular craftsman. I mean, in almost all of his plays, the minute they start, you sort of know you're in great hands. You know that, you just know. Not so much so with Clifford Odets.
So, right. You know. So Miller had a big effect on you.
Yeah, not initially. I mean, he did when I was a kid.
All those guys you were talking about, like Foreman and Wilson and, I've seen those plays and I've seen Foreman stuff and I've seen, you know, some of the like Spalding Gray stuff. I mean, yeah, I guess when you're younger and you see that stuff, it makes you realize that there's no real, you really decide your own limitations.
Yeah. Yeah. And that, I mean, all of those people worked in an incredibly complicated way in relationship to forms that had gone before them. I mean, there are, you know, all those plays that Spalding Gray did with Liz LeCompte, where each one was based on a Great American, A Long Day's Journey Into Night, or, you know, I mean, they had direct reference to specific works of American theater, and Spalding always presented himself as just a New York actor.
Right.
I love Miller. I think the first person, the first playwright that I kind of fell in love with I read him in a modern drama class at Columbia, was John Guare. I read House of Blue Leaves.
Yeah, I met that guy. I kind of know that guy a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think he's
still around, isn't he?
Yes, he is. Yes. And he's a very, very great playwright. I think one of our best.
Huh.
And then Tennessee Williams came next.
Uh-huh.
And then I think Eugene O'Neill and then Arthur Miller. My big obsession during my college years, and to some extent, I'd still say next to Shakespeare, probably the playwright I have the deepest abiding affection for is Bertolt Brecht.
I don't know if I understand him or know exactly what characterizes Brechtian things.
Oh, at some point we probably don't have time to do that now, but I'd love to talk to you about it. He takes the fundamental truth of the theater, which is, I think, in everything that Shakespeare does, that you're confronted with theater's power is that it is bad at making illusions. So you're watching something that isn't really believable. At the end of Hamlet, everybody's dead on the stage, but two of them at least have had a sword fight, so they're panting hard.
Yeah.
And but if it's a great production of Hamlet, you're kind of annihilated at the end,
right?
Emotionally.
Yeah.
And that doubleness, of complete investment in a reality that you know to be artificial is critical consciousness. It's what Marx is writing about. It's like, how do you see beneath the apparent surface of things to what really lies beneath? And, you know, Marx's point, I mean, Freud would say it's the workings of the unconscious.
Right.
Marx would say it's the relations of capital. It's the relations, human relations that have gone to produce commodity forms.
Right.
And what Brecht is all about is, I mean, he's basically just a very great playwright, but his theater is about sort of privileging that moment of belief and disbelief so that you're always, you know, you're in it and you're out at the same time. I mean, I always think like a great example of it is just Jack Nicholson's entire film career, because I just saw this outtake I'd never seen before online from The Shining, where everybody's getting ready to do the scene where he's breaking through the door of the axe. Yeah. And all these ADs are running around saying, you know, talking to Kubrick on walkie-talkies. And Nicholson is behind them looking completely insane, jumping up and down and going, "It's murder today, murder today." And then he reaches over and he picks up this huge axe and starts swinging it. And they're all ducking while they're trying to get the set ready for the shot. And Shelley Duvall just sort of walks through, rolling her eyes, and goes in the bathroom and shuts the door. And he looks completely nuts. But the thing that makes him so incredibly great is that he has this weird ability. He's always in it and out of it at the same time. He's always in it, and he's also commenting on it.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah,
and it's how an actor does that. There are just some actors that really do. Some people lose, you know, go away completely and apart.
There's not too many actors really that do it.
No. But I think a lot of musical theater performers. I never got to see her on stage. I saw Zero Mostel briefly do one old revival of Fiddler. I never got to see Ethel Merman on stage, but when I listen to her recordings, she has that.
Well, I think it's necessary as a musical theater star in a way.
Yeah. Well, you're, you know, there's a formalism, there's an artificiality.
Yeah. I saw your musical. I saw Carolina Change.
Oh, great.
Yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it a lot. That's sort of like, it seemed a very personal thing.
It's the closest to an autobiographical thing. It's dedicated to the woman that, her name is Maudie Lee Davis. She's still alive. She lives in Lake Charles, and she worked as a maid for my family when I was a little kid, all the way till I left for college. And then she continued to work until my father died. And she's retired now, but I dedicated the play to her because Caroline is sort of loosely modeled on her.
Yeah.
It's not a documentary account of things, but there are certain things that happen in the play that happened to me and to Maudie. So yeah, it's very personal.
Did she see it?
Yes, she did. When I finished writing it, I was nervous about it. So I sent it to her. Sort of wasn't sure that she'd ever read a play before. And but I called her and I said, "Maudie, I'm sending you this thing and I'd like you to read it. It's not about you, but it's loosely based on you. And I want to dedicate it to you." And she said, "Well, that's so nice." And oh my God. And she said, "Well, send it." So I sent it. And she immediately sent it to her daughter, Carolyn. Carolyn read it for her. Uh-huh. And then called her and said, it's very touching. And Carolyn really liked it. So then Maudie said that she was honored and pleased. And then when it was opening at the Public Theater, I flew her and Carolyn to New York, and I was terrified. I didn't know Tanya Pinkins, who played the part, who created the role.
Yeah.
When Tanya had her wig on, her 1960s wig on, she really looked like Maudie.
Yeah.
And that wasn't deliberate. It just happened to be that they looked a little bit alike.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh my God, what if she's really up? I mean, because I made this character like I remember Maudie being. She was different from a lot of the other African-American women who worked as maids. They put on this, you know, friendly mask because you had to. Uh-huh. She didn't really do that. She was a kind of a tough And often very angry person. And so that's, I was fascinated by that then. And I wrote her that way. After she cried and she really loved it. She met the cast. Then we were in the cab going back to my place. And she was in the middle and I was on one side and Carolyn was on the other side. And I said, so what did you think of, she talked about the play, but she hadn't said anything about the character. I said, what did you think of Carolyn? And she said, well, I liked her. She would do anything for her kids. And I liked that. And I said, right. I said, but you know, what about the angry stuff? Do you think is that fair? Do you feel like that has any relationship to the way you used to be before you turned into this very sweet old lady? And when he said, oh, no, I was never like that. I was never angry like that. And I could see on the other side, Carolyn was looking at her going, so I, okay. You know, of course I got it right.
Oh, good. You chose a musical to do that, to explore yourself like that.
Yeah, it was one of the first. When I was a sophomore in college, I decided that maybe I wanted to be a playwright. I didn't want to own it, but I began to get interested in the idea. And I keep a journal, and I wrote in my journal, if I can come up with 13 ideas for plays in 1 hour, 12 ideas for plays in 1 hour,
yeah,
I think maybe I can be a playwright. So I came up with 12 ideas. And I don't remember what any of the others were, but one of them was, they're really short little paragraphs, and one of them was an African-American woman who works as a maid in the Deep South and in some way is also president of the United States. And that's the only thing I wrote. And that stayed with me. And that sort of San Francisco Opera hired Bobby McFarlane to compose an opera. And he asked me if I'd do the libretto. And I wrote Caroline for that. And then Bobby decided he didn't want to write an opera. He played around with it, but he decided he was a jazz musician and not really an opera composer.
Who, Bobby McFerrin?
McFerrin, right.
Yeah.
And so he gave me the rights to the libretto back. And then I went to George Wolfe and we went to Janine Tesori. And then
that's it.
I think because my parents were musicians, it was something, it was a, I didn't think I ever really wanted to, you know, I mean, they say that Tennessee Williams really made life hard for himself by starting his career by writing Glass Menagerie.
Yeah.
O'Neill waited till practically the end of his career to write Long Day's Journey. But something really autobiographical always seemed scary to me.
Right.
Maybe because it was going to be a musical and my parents were musicians, it felt like it would be the right moment to dig.
Yeah, but also, like, you know, when you think about, you know, O'Neill, it's like, it doesn't sound like you're going to go down a tunnel of darkness for, you know, how dark is it going to get for you?
Oh, I wish I could get that dark. I mean, he was the greatest.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he was.
But I mean, autobiographically speaking, maybe this was.
I'm glad I didn't have his family.
Yeah.
Have you ever visited the house? If you're.
No.
If you're ever on I-95 between like New York and through Connecticut.
Yeah.
In New London, Connecticut is the Monte Cristo cottage. It's the cottage that his father, who was an enormously successful actor, bought. And it's the cottage in which Long Day's Journey is set in 1912.
Oh, wow. Yeah, and yeah.
It's a National Historic Registry landmark. It's run by the Parks Department, but it's really weird because it's not, you know, like, you know, some sort of big mountain range or something or a beautiful forest. It's this terrifying house where four people, you know, ate each other, basically. And it's the one of the weirdest national landmarks in the United States. It's absolutely worth a visit. It's it's and you can just, the minute you go in, the unhappiness is still there. I mean, it's just
you can feel it in the wood.
Oh, you really can. It's a spooky, place.
So the whole journey of Angels for you, you know, one and two, I mean, that was like how long a period of your life? Like a decade?
Yeah, I started in 87. I finished part one in around 88, 89. It opened at the National in London in 1990. I had already written a very rough draft of the second part. The first part, I think, eventually, then it came to, went to the Mark Taper Forum, and then it came to Broadway by 93. And then in 94, Perestroika opened, and then the National Tour went on. So yeah, it was about 8 or 9 years.
And that was like, but that was your, like the first big play, and it was huge. And it's like eternal.
It was huge.
And it's never, it's always going to be huge.
Well, you know, Kenahara, poo, poo, poo. All I care is that it outlasts me. Yeah. After that, it's on its own. But.
And when you put that together, I mean, were you able to see, you know, like when you talk about like a thoroughness of character or being true to, you know, who they are and what's happening in the play, like, and it seems like, you know, when the angel comes down, that's spectacular, that, you know, something enabled you, you know, to sort of like conceive of that.
No, right? I had a dream. It was a dream.
Okay.
That's how it started. Right. The first guy that I had known personally to die of AIDS, I was doing a year residency in St. Louis on a National Endowment of the Arts fellowship in directing. And I got word that this dancer named Bill, who I'd gone to graduate school with at NYU, had just died. And I was sad about that. And I went to bed that night and I had a dream that he was in his pajamas on his bed and looking terrified up at the ceiling, which started to bulge, and then it cracked open and an angel came into the room. And
wow.
And then so there it was.
That's amazing, right? I didn't know that. I'm sure you, that's out there to know, but because that moment in the show is like, it's just overwhelming.
That was supposed to be the intermission of a 3-hour, 2-hour, 2.5-hour play. It didn't work out that way. It wound up getting longer than that. I feel like we all contain multitudes, and
sure,
sort of one of the things that you try to do as a writer is loosen the stays that the internal stays that hold you together as a person just enough so that stuff that ordinarily in everyday waking life you would keep securely locked away, you kind of loosen the hinges and the doors a little bit and things start come out. And
that's a good way to look at it. So when you, like, the one thing I like when I was thinking about, like, I watched your West Side Story or in Spielberg's, and then, like, you know, an hour later I watched the other one, like, so I was able to really kind of see them both like that, you know, to see, because I didn't remember the original. I think I saw it when I was a kid, and, you know, like, I wanted to see what stayed and what went and what, you know, what was different, you know. And they both are pretty spectacular, you know, on their own, right? So when you take when Steven Spielberg asks you to do this, as he's asked you to do other movies with him, I don't know, I assume they were different. But I mean, what's the first thing you do in terms of, like, how are you going to reboot this thing? What do you think? Like, do you say to yourself, like, well, look, the race issue is there, but the class issue is unexplored?
Well, in a certain sense, that is where Steven started. I mean, the first I said, why do you want to do this? Because we both love the 61 film very much.
Yeah.
And I said, why do you want to do it? And he said, you know, there were a few things that he was interested in. The fact that cameras are so much more mobile now. You can move them around. You can, you know.
Technical stuff.
Yeah. I mean, you know, that things that really get Steven excited.
Yeah.
He wanted to do a musical. He's always wanted to do a musical, and it's arguably the greatest musical. But he also said, you know, I feel like these are street kids and they're very poor. So we began talking about poverty, and poverty as being this kind of, along with racism and xenophobia, poverty is kind of the overarching meta villain of the tragedy.
Yeah.
And that led me to start researching the area that these guys were writing about, where I live right now, Lincoln Square, what was called Lincoln Square.
Like, isn't it a Robert Moses development?
Yeah, there was in 57 Moses and the Committee for Slum Clearance won 2 Supreme Court cases and blasted away a gigantic part of the West Side. Part of it was a real slum that was primarily inhabited by the left behinds of earlier generations of European immigrants that had come and sort of left their mentally challenged and the sort of criminal element drug addict and so on were left behind. And they were living in these kind of derelict brownstones. The top of Lincoln Square was called San Juan Hill, not because it had anything to do with Puerto Rico, but it had been called San Juan Hill for a long time. I think I finally figured out why, but that's another story.
Why?
I can't prove this, but people don't know where the name came from. It was an African-American neighborhood from about the teens into the 40s. And then when Black people started moving up to Harlem, they began renting these their apartment buildings that they owned to Puerto Ricans who were just arriving in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And but they'd always called it San Juan Hill. And I have no way of proving this, but the Rough Riders, when they wrote up San Juan Hill, which is in Cuba, is one part of the story that I forget the name of the hill next to San Juan Hill, but there was another hill held by the Spanish that had a fort on it that was protecting San Juan Hill, and the fortress atop San Juan Hill. For the Rough Riders to be able to get up the hill, they had to first, somebody had to take the adjoining hill and you know, sort of neutralize the fort. And the people who did that, there were a couple of garrison platoons that did it, but one of them was an all-Black U.S. Army infantry squadron, and they stormed the fortress and took that hill. And they were, of course, then completely written out of history. It was all about the Rough Riders and Teddy Roosevelt, who were all white, charging up that hill. But the Black people that had made it possible were forgotten. And I have no way of proving this, but I really wonder, because the timing seems to work out, if the veterans from the Army veterans who felt themselves to have been great American heroes, as they were, forgotten, decided to name this neighborhood that they were moving into and maybe buying real estate into with their pensions, if they decided to call that neighborhood San Juan Hill. And then it became a Puerto Rican neighborhood. So
I think that's pretty good speculation.
I don't know, maybe.
Good research. Good connections.
I thought maybe that's the
you did the good thinking on that.
Thank you very much.
So you decide to set it, you know, very specifically in this wreckage.
In the wreckage, and which became, you know, I think a really significant sort of aspect of the film that people, I love anything about a scarcity economy. I love movies, books, plays where an artificial scarcity is created and the people that are fighting that are sort of set against each other to compete for the very little bits of usually not very valuable whatever that's left because of this artificially created scarcity, the fighting becomes more and more violent and ugly.
Yeah.
I think because there's a real enemy that isn't present where the actual power lies. And I think that frustration amplifies the fight between groups that don't really have anything to fight about. And in this case, you know, these little white racist street kids and this kind of neighborhood protection group, the Sharks, we're trying to keep their neighborhood together. So that's how
you conceived of it. And it's interesting, like watching them both side by side, is that a lot of the race stuff and the xenophobic stuff is really in it, you know, and a lot of the it's very uncomfortable. And once you, I guess, you know, once you get past the blackface stuff, which is, I guess, the nature of movies at that time, you know, the dancing and the tension and the emotions of it are all there. But like what really happens in your version is that there's a depth to it that connects them all. Like you don't, there's not the same, you know, outside of like this neighborhood's always shitty, but there is something, like you're saying, there's something bigger than them that's setting this, you know, in motion.
Yeah.
And it's not addressed by them specifically, maybe a little bit with the women singing, their understanding of a possible future that's false, or even their understanding of what's really happening seems the most grounded understanding politically in the whole piece.
I mean, I think I'm really glad that you said that, because I think that, I mean, I felt like what we were doing the whole way was taking, you know, I think the musical, the original musical, is a masterpiece. I think it's a great work of art. And all the things that we wanted to talk about and deal with, and that we did talk about and deal with and address in the movie that we just made, I think are latent and latent but present in one way or another.
Yes.
In the original Broadway musical and in the 61 film. And so it felt like we had a new opportunity to look at it and to sort of draw some of those things. We got permission from everybody and support to do that. And
I thought that the decision to have no subtitles, I think, was good. And I think that white people deserve it.
I sort of feel that way, too. Also, practically speaking, being Puerto Rican Spanish, you know, is filled with English idioms. So you'd have a hard time, I think, subtitling. It'd like be, you know, that there are people who are struggling with whether or not they want to speak Spanish or speak English, and they can speak both. So you'd be popping into subtitles all the time, and it also sort of then makes English the official language of the movie. And I think it, you know,
yeah,
I've been enjoying how freaked out people on the right, like on Fox News, were that this is there's unsubtitled Spanish in the film, so stay away. Because if you go, you won't have any idea what's going on.
Are they really doing that?
Yeah. There was a real sort of like, oh my God, this is woke culture taking over. And it was like, yeah, you know, don't panic. Steven Spielberg is not going to make a movie where huge numbers of people have no idea what's going on. Just go and, you know. And,
yeah, I got it. I'm the same way with Shakespeare, to be honest with you. I get the idea.
Yeah,
I can't.
Exactly.
I don't know what really they're talking about, but I understand the story.
You'll be okay. You'll
exactly
catch up. Yeah.
Now, what was your biggest fear going into it around, you know, taking this work? Yeah. See, who do you get permission from? Jerome Robbins? Who do you get permission?
Well, Stephen got permission from the Jerome Robbins estate, the Leonard Bernstein's three kids, Alex, Jamie, and Nina. And Arthur Lawrence's estate, this man named David Saint, who was Arthur's partner, and then Sondheim. They all had to pre-approve me as a screenwriter. Uh-huh. I know the Bernstein kids, and I knew Arthur Lawrence and David, and I knew Steve Sondheim for a really long time. So that was pretty easy, but they gave Stephen permission. You know, Sondheim at least was very, and Arthur Lawrence and I think Bernstein were fairly critical of the 61 film. I don't think they were fair about it. I think they were a little grouchy and unfair.
But, really?
But they were not. Yeah. Famously, Arthur Lawrence, when he finished watching the movie for the first time, said, "Wow, that's a really tough gang of ballerinas."
What are you going to do?
But we got permission.
Dancing
is dancing. And they were great. I mean, all the changes that I proposed, giving Rita somewhere.
Oh, Rita was great. But, you know, I thought that was really the most interesting story point that, you know, that you sort of were able to dig into was to give that kid, the lead, you know, a backstory. There's no backstory. In the
yeah,
other
I mean, one. In 57, they, you know, they were doing a lot of radical things with West Side Story that nobody had ever done before, bringing a type of person on stage that had not been brought on the Broadway stage before, and making a musical tragedy, which no one had done before. I mean, Rodgers and Hammerstein made sad musicals, but they really wanted to follow Romeo and Juliet and make a tragedy, and I think they succeeded. So with all of that that they were doing, and also it's a dance musical, it's sort of driven by dance, with all the things that they were trying that hadn't been tried before, they made a couple of concessions to convention. And one of them was that the boy and the girl in the A plot had to be good kids. They couldn't be juvenile delinquents. They had to be from good families and nice kids. And then everybody else could be tougher and rougher. And we don't need to worry about that anymore. So,
well, to the point where there was like outside of him deciding to work, you know, as opposed to be in the street. I mean, that's all you got with that kid. And she was, you know, young. So there was no, but I just thought the backstory was compelling to have that inner struggle, you know, with himself.
Yeah. Well, thanks. I felt it worked really well.
How did the thing with Spielberg start with you guys?
When Angels in America, Mike Nichols' version came out on HBO, the minute you have anything happen on, you know, a movie or a TV show or something come out, you get calls from producers who say, "Let's have breakfast."
Sure.
And I got a call from Kathy Kennedy saying, "Let's have breakfast. I'm going to be in New York and I'd like to meet you." And you just meet and you have breakfast and they say, "What are you doing?" And you say, what are you doing? And I said to Kathy, what are you guys working on? And she said, we're working on two films, you and Steven. And she said, we're working on two films. One is about the murder of the Israeli athletes at the Munich Olympics in 1972. And the other is adapting Doris Kearns Goodwin's book, forthcoming book, Team of Rivals, about Abraham Lincoln. And I said, those are great projects.
Yeah.
And then right as we were about to leave, I said, you know, I just published, I edited with a friend, Elisa Solomon, an anthology of essays about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict called Wrestling with Zion. And I said, I'm really proud of the book. And if you guys are going to make a thing about the Munich Olympics massacre, maybe you'd find stuff of value in it. So if you'd like, I'd be happy to send it to you. And I did. And I thought, well, that's the end of that.
Yeah.
And then about 2 weeks later, I got a phone call. It was Spielberg. And he said, I just read the essays and I really like them. And I'd like to talk to you about this script. And we got together. He sent me the script. I read it. We talked about it. And then he said, would you like to try and write your own version of it? And I said, yes. And now we just this summer finished our fourth movie together. So it'll be coming out in Thanksgiving.
Which movie is that?
It's about his childhood. We wrote it on Zoom, just like what we're doing now.
No kidding.
During lockdown, we wrote it. It's the fastest thing I've ever wrote. We co-wrote the script together. It's about Stephen's childhood and his sort of the beginnings of his...
Of him running around with his Super 8 camera?
Yeah, Super 8 camera and then 16 millimeter. And it's also about his parents and his parents' marriage falling apart. And it's...
Interesting.
That's Michelle Williams and Paul Dano are in it and Seth Rogen. And it's I'm very excited about it.
Wow, that's amazing. So he finally does an autobiographical picture and he needs you to help him out.
I was like his shrink.
Well, that's a good question about like with Munich. I mean, what was the challenge characterologically? And you know, because I mean, you seem to be, you know, driven by dialogue. You like people talking. So
yeah.
What did you need to show with that? You know, I was in Hebrew school when that happened. I was like 9 years old, and I remember when it happened. And I remember there being this weekly magazine we used to get at Hebrew school about all those athletes. So what was it that you needed to, what was it that, you know, with what you were saying before about forces and about people, you know, at odds with each other in situations that are out of their control. So what was it with Munich where you're like, I'm going to do this project because this needs to be seen? What was it?
Well, I was I didn't know why Stephen wanted to go into this incredibly dark event and this sort of terrible moment. I was nervous that it was going to be that it would demonize the Palestinian people. That was, you know, of course, think that what was done to the Israeli athletes at the Olympics was horrendous and, you know, inexcusable and unforgivable, monstrous act. But I believe that, you know, the plight of the Palestinian people is a world historic calamity. And as a Jew, I support the existence of the State of Israel. I'm very much identified as a Jew. And I also think that the way that the Palestinians have been treated is unforgivable and inexcusable. And violence begets violence. And I, you know, it was also right after 9/11. So I thought there was a lot of room for exploration. The movie addresses Israel's decision to eliminate ostensibly the planners of the massacre, but in the process they also got rid of most of the people who they deemed as being important people in the PLO, and they chose to do this in violation of a huge number of international treaties and, you know, sort of setting aside the rule of law. And so I thought that was an interesting thing to look at, and the idea of these Jewish Mossad agents who were essentially assassins going around and, you know, and planning it. I thought that was fascinating. Eric Roth had written a version of the script that I thought was really good. And, you know, I've always admired Stephen as a filmmaker enormously. And I thought, well, you know, it would be an interesting thing to explore with him. And
yeah.
And I was taken by how dangerous it was for the guy that made Schindler's List and who is, you know, a Jewish filmmaker beloved by Jews, to take this on. And I was very impressed that I didn't need to like sell him on the idea that this is not a situation of like, you know,
the Israelis are the good guys and win.
The Israelis are the good guys and the Palestinians are monsters who subhuman evil people who for some reason can't leave us alone. So I wanted to see, I wanted to become part of his process of exploring that. And you know, I was stunned. I'm always stunned with Stephen because he's such a complete master of the art of filmmaking and of the art of storytelling. I mean, he's like, not since Dickens has there been anybody, I think, more profoundly gifted at the construction of narrative. And he's an incredibly generous collaborator. He really invited me in. He kept me on set the whole time.
Did you argue?
Oh, we argued terribly.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit less on Munich than with Lincoln, where we really...
What were those arguments about?
Oh, about everything. I mean,
oh, really?
And I lose a lot of them, and I also win some.
What was the big problem? What was the struggle with Lincoln?
There's never like just one thing.
Yeah.
There are always, you know, there were just subtleties and complexities in the situation. I mean, I wrote a 500 page first draft.
Yeah.
It covered from January to April of 1855. And I thought Stephen would film the last month at the end of the war when Lincoln was down at City Point with Grant. What he wound up filming was the first part, which was the fight for the 13th Amendment. And I think it's a brilliant choice that he made just to focus on that. But when we did that, we wound up making a movie about the House of Representatives. And
yeah,
in a world where the Democrats are the bad, reactionary, horrible people,
yeah,
and the Republicans are the progressive, liberal, decent people. And keeping track of all of that was hard. And there are lots of things. Stephen also doesn't like to rehearse. And he can get excited when actors improvise, and I hate it.
Yeah.
And we've always had a big struggle about that. I want them to stick to the script. And in Lincoln, sometimes, you know, this is not about an actor. I was watching, and I think I made a pest of myself that day about 600 other little things. And I went running onto the set. I watched from Video Village. I'm running on the set. And I said, Stephen, you've got to stop for a second. We've got to change something. And he said, well, I don't want to change. We're behind. I want to keep going. And I said, no, they're packing up Lincoln's office. It was a scene where they're packing up the war charts because the war is essentially over right before he goes to the theater and gets killed. And they're putting things in a box that had been marked for the National Archives. And I said, you can't do that. The National Archives were founded in 1932.
Yeah.
So you have to get rid of that box. And there are, you know, little things like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I won't tell tales out of school. Yeah. But the great thing about him is he really, with West Side Story, we had a ton of things where we were, you know, where we were trying. I mean, I think the reason it turned out as well as it did is that everybody involved was constantly just slightly adjusting things to make sure that we were telling as rich and full and true a story as we could. And
it's great. It's such an aggressive collaboration.
Yeah, it is. It doesn't. I mean, I've known him now for a really long time, and I love him as a person. And I, you know, I feel it like it's an incredible privilege because I think he's.
Sure.
I mean, I don't use this word very often, but I really do think he's a genius. And
yeah.
I think he's capable of doing things. When you work with him over and over, he'll come up with some shot or some image just out of the thin air, it looks like, and you can't understand where it comes from. He doesn't always explain it well.
Who decided to make Lincoln 20 feet tall?
I think God decided that.
Yeah. Well, that's an amazing thing to say. It reminds me of that moment where, on a much lesser scale in some way, because it's a different medium. Where I don't know if you watched the Beatles documentary.
Oh God, that was
where Paul's just amazing. Sort of like pulling Get Back out of the air, you know, and you're like, that's what it's happening right now. It's happening.
And there, and what I love is he's sitting there at the piano, just he's playing Get Back, and then he's sitting there playing Long and Winding Road,
yeah,
or Let It Be, yeah. And they're all rolling their eyes and making fun of it, and even yeah. he's making fun of it. And it's like, well, wait a minute, this is like one of the greatest songs ever written, and it's happening. What I'm really curious about, and nobody's been able to explain it to me, is Get Back was clearly about nativism, and I mean, you know, because at one point McCartney says, the Pakistani, da, 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 and then there's also somebody's a Puerto Rican. And so it's clearly about immigrants, not, or in the case of Puerto Ricans, migrants, not being welcomed somewhere. And Get Back was get back to where you once belonged. And you hear it, and then in one of those moments when they're not on camera and they break up for a few days, they come back and it's turned into
a song about nothing.
Except Beatles Nothing, which is better yeah. than anything. Yeah. You want to hear one great thing that I found out what's the song? Here Come All Flat Top, He Come Grooving Up Slowly.
Come Together.
I just read, I hope this is true, that Lennon came up with that when Timothy Leary, who was running for governor against Ronald Reagan, asked Lennon to write him a campaign song, and he came up with a song, and Leary, for whatever reason, wasn't yeah. organized enough to make use of it, so it didn't get
hilarious.
I love that, because then you know who Old Flat Top must sure, have been yeah. come Old Flat
oh
Top.
That's interesting.
It's clearly Ronald Reagan, right?
Oh, I wonder if that's true.
I think it would be, I want to write a film or a play where Leary takes the song and it becomes his campaign song, and he beats Reagan for governor. It was Reagan's first successful campaign, and he beats Reagan. So Reagan just goes back to being a GE spokesman or whatever, and he yeah. really just leaves the American political stage. And the entire history of the United States after that is
altered.
Reaganism. Yeah. We stay on course, and we become a bigger and better and healthier democracy.
That is an amazing hallucination.
Wouldn't it be nice?
Yeah. So this discomfort with improvising. Now, is this something like, cause there's a big chunk of time between, you know, Columbia and Angels, you know, how was that? Was that wrought with difficulty in becoming a playwright because of behavior that you may have had?
You mean?
Well, I mean, were you difficult?
I am difficult. I'm a horrible person. Ask any of the directors who've worked for me, I'm a nightmare. It took me a while. I went to graduate school to be a director. I think I was afraid to be a writer. Okay. Writing is hard, writing is scary, and I couldn't quite believe that I'd be good at it. And I'm actually an okay director, a stage director. I don't have any idea how to direct a movie, but I'm okay. I'm not really great at it. And I think I went into directing because it was a way of sort of coming into playwriting through the back door.
Was it helpful?
Yes. The WRIGHT part of playwriting, there is a part of this that, as I was saying about Arthur Miller, is really craft. It's really like cobbling together a skeleton that will hold this event together. And you have to learn, I think, a certain amount about how actors work.
Yeah,
and you know, you learn if you spend time with actors, with really good actors, and you see what they're struggling with. You learn some of the. They're not. None of it is rocket science. It's all pretty simple. But you learn what anybody who comes out on stage comes out to do something. At least this is true in narrative realist drama. You come out on stage to have an action, to do something, and you either succeed or you fail. You run into somebody who doesn't want you to have stuff. Right. But it's amazing to me always how many people who act and many people who direct and sometimes even people who write don't quite get that that's where the drama and drama comes from. And
what, the doing things?
Yeah, that action. You need an action, and also that speech is action.
Right.
Which is why I get annoyed when people improvise. A little annoyed.
Yeah.
We just made this movie and Seth Rogen was on the set, and Stephen kept teasing me before we started. I'd never met him before, and Stephen said, "You know, Seth Rogen, it's like he's going to be Mr. Improv. I mean, he's not going to do a single line that we wrote. He's going to make it all up." And I thought, well, at least he really knows how to improvise, which most people don't. And
did he?
Not. He was word perfect the entire time.
He was probably terrified.
No, I think he said, "I really like the script and I really want it. I can do my thing with my stuff. And I wanted to come here and really
honor the thing,
and explore it."
I'm excited. Excited about the movie. Loved West Side Story. It was a great.
Oh, well, thanks, Mark. Thank you very much.
It was great talking to you. Say hi to Mark for me.
I will. Well, this has been a lot of fun.
It has. Mm-hmm. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Wow, that was rich. Is that the right word for it? Nice, rich, deep, thoughtful, and it was made my brain go all the places. West Side Story is playing in theaters now. I would go see it. It's pretty great. So that was fun. Tony Kushner. I'm just gonna whip out some guitar. I'm gonna whip it out. Here we go. Folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here. And when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.